This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll hear from Richard Antoine White, the first African-American to earn a doctorate in tuba performance, talk about his new memoir. A reminder, this segment is not live. We're joined by Richard Antoine White, principal tubist of the New Mexico Philharmonic and Santa Fe Symphony, professor at the University of New Mexico, and a graduate of the Peabody Institute and Indiana University. We're discussing his new memoir, I'm Possible, A Story of Survival, a Tuba, and the Small Miracle of a Big Dream. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you. I found your memoir just riveting, and I'm curious to know why you felt it was important to share this story.
You know, I think my purpose now in life is just to inspire hope. And, you know, as the title, Impossible, Unpossible, Against All Odds. I think, especially now more than ever in our world and country's hurting, it's important to give people hope. It's important, whether they're at an advantage or disadvantage, to just show everyone that they can do it. And that's the purpose of my book, is simply to inspire hope across the country and further.
I noticed in the opening of the book, you'd mentioned just about it kind of opens up on a scene of you getting ready to play and then talking about how you came from all these hardships and now it's possible for you and how it's possible for anyone. What made you feel like what you went through is something that anybody can overcome?
I was blessed with an extraordinary imagination. And I think a lot of people have dreams and imagination, and they just don't feed it. I think, you know, there's this old tale that says, you know, if you have a good person and a bad person, which person will grow the most? The person you feed the most, you know. I'm lucky that I was able to feed that good person that had some self-determination and that had an imagination and a dream that I was determined not to give up on, you know. And I also say in the book that sometimes in life you have to learn to be your own hero. I often credit everyone who helped me, every teacher, every mentor, every friend, definitely helped me along the way. But I did my part by working as hard as I could.
Well, you do write about your childhood in the first part of the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what life was like for you and your mother in Baltimore and how it relates to the bigger story?
You know, we woke up every day. We had two missions. Her mission was to serve her illness. My mission was to be a kid, you know, play, find enough corns in the gutter to get, you know, a chicken gizzard or chicken wing. Oftentimes, I'm pretty sure I didn't have enough money when I, you know, looked up, like it was like the Eiffel Tower or something. That's how tall the chicken stand looked when you were 4 years old, to get whatever I was trying to purchase. But every day was simply about living, surviving, and finding my mom. So I would play, find enough food or somehow eat. And then at the end of the day, I would look for her. And sometimes I was successful in finding her and sometimes I wasn't.
When it comes to the relationship that you had with your mom, you mentioned also in the book that some people said your mother wasn't capable of taking care of you. How did that affect you?
I think my mom is a hero. I think she did the most difficult thing that any parent can do, and that's to give her kid up so that I could have a better life. I think she was dealt a hand and she played it to the best of her ability. And she would give me the shirt off of her back. I think, you know, our society is used to labeling and stereotyping because of the illness of alcoholism. Sure, she had a disease, but she loved me like any mom would love their kid and cared for me like any mom would care for their kid as best she could. And I'm grateful for that. And oftentimes I'm asked, would I change anything? The answer is absolutely not.
And that's an amazing way to look at things. As you said, there's so many stereotypes about illnesses, and we often overlook the humanistic side of the person that's suffering.
Yes, and I think I've always preached, and I hope this message catches on like wildfire. There are thousands of problems in our country and world, and we're really hurting right now. I honestly believe that 99% of them can be solved if we were just kind to one another.
Yes, kindness can go a long way. I'm with you on that. And for our listeners who are tuning in, if you have any questions or comments for the program, for our guest, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3311. 3881. So tell us a little bit about this bond that you and your mother shared. It seems like it carried throughout.
Yeah, I think like animals, humans, there's a connection between mother and child. And I think we shared that connection where it was just me and her. And, you know, all things are possible. Just like any parent will go the distance, any parents will go beyond the distance to protect and to make sure their child is taken care of. In terms of resources, we all have differences in terms of how far we can take that child. I totally enjoyed my time with my mom. I enjoyed the stories she told me. I enjoyed the togetherness of her. And I'm always fascinated by that word, you know, because if you break it down, it says to get her. And ultimately, I have decided in 48 years of age now that it means to get her. And I think it really means to get Lady Liberty, to really have the three C's in life. A chance, choice, and change. We all just want a chance to make the right choices to see the kind of change that we desire for betterment.
Now, on your journey, as we look back to the memoir here, there was a chapter about the blizzard and how major changes started to happen for you. Can you tell us about what that was like from I guess, your early childhood to this incident?
You mean after the blizzard or during the blizzard?
After the blizzard.
Oh, I had difficulties. I moved in with his foster parents, whom, first of all, I think I actually call their house Buckingham Palace, which it was amazing because you ate three meals a day. I would have just giant, to me, seemed like the biggest sandwich ever. So I would stick half of it in my pocket and eat half of it. And they were like, this is all yours. If you want another one, just ask for it. And I'm looking at them like, yeah, right. I'm going to keep this sandwich in my pocket. I was so angry at them. At that age, for taking me away from my mom, that I talked to myself in the mirror for years. I was my best friend. I literally talked to myself. Sure, I had concepts of, you know, bathing and all that, but, you know, having a bath and then putting on these things called pajamas, that was not in my resume. So I would take a bath, they would wash me up, put me into bed, and I would find my dirty clothes and end up on the floor because that's what I was most comfortable with. So I had a lot of adjusting to do.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that's a huge adjustment to go from living one lifestyle to another. And what was it like? Was it more freedom when you were out with your mother versus having sort of rules and structure?
Yeah, you know, sometimes we had, you know, what I classify my homelessness as intermittent, you know. Aunt or someone would have us stay, and I would sleep in the bed with like six other people. If someone wet the bed, that was just your problem, things like that. And so we didn't have a regimented place. You didn't take a bath every day. You didn't brush your teeth every day. It was where you ended up. You dealt with the environment and the circumstances that were in front of you. So certainly the rules and the culture when I'm the transition was something that I had never experienced before.
I would think that also those types of experiences build a lot of resilience and ability to adapt.
Oh, it definitely gave me attitude to determine. I think in the movie, the film Ratuba, we met an old neighbor on the streets, and she said, yeah, last time I saw him, he was barefoot. He was waiting for his mom in the rain, and I asked him if he wanted a sandwich, and he said no. I wanted the sandwich, but I was just so tired of asking people for stuff that I just didn't. I was done with it. I was going to find my own way.
And what was it like, you know, when with this new structure, now you're sort of in a new chapter. Did anything sort of open up for you or change your perspective?
Oh, yeah. Like I can answer this a lot of ways. You mean living wise or just the trajectory of my whole life? Because that's how I would approach this question.
Yeah, I would say probably the trajectory.
In fourth grade, a music person came to school with a whole bunch of music instruments. And we got to choose what we wanted to play. And I said, I want to play trumpet. It's got to be easy. It only has three vowels. Boy, was I wrong. Trumpet is hard to play. I started playing trumpet. And I was failing. I wasn't performing well in school. And my parents had the genius idea to take the trumpet and to tell me that, give me an ultimatum, turn your grades around or you will never see this trumpet again. I was so determined to get that trumpet back because what music gave to me is a sense of belonging. is a sense of something that I create with like-minded people. So I've never failed a class since, a grade since, I should say.
So the trumpet was that the gateway for you to music, or did you have an interest before that?
Mom would sing to me on the streets, but I think it was the gateway to a lot of things. I think it was the gateway to community. I think it was the gateway to a sense of unity. I think it was the gateway to communication. And I think it was also, because of my failure, the gateway to determination.
So it sounds like you were never intimidated by these instruments. And I say this because I think, you know, when I see instruments, I feel intimidated. It's like a lot of work. You have to figure out how to play them and make it sound good. How did you approach it?
There are a lot of different ways to look at it. I think I definitely strip things down to their basic element, but I do take the long way to do things. Like I can make something very simple, very difficult. But once I get it, I got it. I'm always reminded of a quote that Bill Gates used. And he says, "I will always choose a lazy person to do a difficult job because he or she will find the easiest way to do it." So I'm not saying that I'm a lazy person and I find the easiest way to do things right away, but I take the long way, try every which way possible, and then end up with the best way for me to do it.
Before we take a quick break, what was it like putting this memoir together? And we can probably pick up on this after the break as well. And just having to delve back into sort of emotional topics.
It's surreal. First of all, I had to contact a family that I don't remember or didn't know. I had to verify the things I was writing down, and I had to actually get credibility to what I was saying. Like, how do I know certain things and don't remember certain things? I had to contact a lot of people. And that was interesting because I was being introduced to feelings I think I suppressed. So a lot of it was very emotional. And it's social media has made things weird. It's weird seeing family members that say that you're family. You're like, I never seen you in my life, and I don't know who you are. Hi. You know, social media definitely made it easier for me to contact people and to track down the facts of the story. But at the same time, I had to deal with the baggage.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break to play us out. We have Richard beatboxing on his tuba in a collaborative track with his brother, William. We're talking about a new memoir from tuba player Richard Antoine White. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. Y'all can't see him now, cause he's a pedigree. You gotta say Dr. White, and that's the pedigree. I got it in, so I'ma just move. And if you understand me, then you know I'm smooth. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and it's the Friday Recap, where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Next up, we'll learn about systemic issues in minor league baseball, from financial hardship to housing insecurity. The working conditions for minor league baseball players are making headlines as players have started opening up about facing financial hardship and housing insecurity. We're back with Harry Marino, Executive Director for Advocates for Minor Leaguers, and Kieran Lovegrove, career minor league pitcher for the Rocket City Trash Pandas in Alabama. Harry, we're touching on the antitrust laws and the relationship with Major League Baseball. Can you give us a quick summary of what exactly this all means?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in 1922, the Supreme Court said that baseball was not subject to the same anti-monopoly laws that apply to every other industry in the United States. And the reason for that is archaic, but basically at this point, nobody agrees that it's a good decision. And since 1922, a lot has changed. And every other sports league has been subject to those anti-monopoly laws. What that means in practice is that major league owners can sit around a table, draft up minor league players, decide how to treat them, decide how much to pay them, decide how long their contract should be, and agree not to compete for each other's players. So take someone like Kieran, very talented baseball player. He gets drafted by a team. You know, they decide we're only going to pay Kieran $500 a week. In a normal industry where the antitrust laws applied, that wouldn't work because another team would come in and say, "Hey, Kieran, you're only making $500 a week, you know, playing for the Angels. If you come and play in the Mets system, we'll give you $1,000 a week. That basic competition for services is so important for workers to recoup the actual value that they are providing to their employers. I mean, that's what the basic, you know, free market system that our country operates on is based on. And workers in every other industry get that, but workers in the minor league, in baseball, and specifically minor league players, don't get a fair market for their services. And so, you know, a lot of times people have said, wow, minor leaguers are treated poorly. We should give them, you know, the minimum wage at least. To me, I kind of reject that premise, because minor league players on an open market would make way, way more than the minimum wage. They are providing tremendous value to their employers, both as prospective major league players and also as, you know, current minor league players who are performing in front of fans at a high level every day. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a hidden secret here that, you know, people don't know about, but this antitrust exemption, it's really pernicious, and it really is a big reason why minor leaguers are subjected to this extraordinarily depressed wage.
It's interesting that this was put together and hasn't been challenged, it sounds like, and it's just kind of swept under the rug.
Yeah, I mean, look, the way the Supreme Court works is once a decision is made, it's a really, really high bar to overturn it based upon, you know, the concept of precedent and stare decisis. And so what we have is a situation where the Supreme Court said something, you know, 100 years ago, and it stood for 100 years. It's going to be a really high bar to overturn it. I will say that there is growing optimism about the Supreme Court actually doing so. And that relates to the Supreme Court case this past spring, NCAA versus Alston, where the court basically opened up the gateway for college athletes to start making money off their name, image, and likeness. In that opinion, the Supreme Court cited a brief that we submitted, our organization, Advocates for Minor Leaguers, talking about baseball's exemption. And in doing so, the court actually mentioned the exemption in a way that really cast some doubt on it. It said this is a so-called exemption, and it really hasn't made a lot of sense. And so that's a signal, you know, for lawyers out there that maybe there is an opportunity to go after that antitrust exemption, you know, and maybe the Supreme Court, the current court, you know, the current nine members of the court, at least, have an appetite for reconsidering that antitrust exemption, because you won't be able to find one lawyer out there who can explain to you why it makes a bit of sense. It just doesn't. And at a certain point, you know, the fact that things have always been a certain way is not a very good justification for the kind of real world hardship that players like Kieran and thousands of others have endured for decades.
Kieran, what was it like for you when you got drafted and started your career in the minor leagues? Did you ever at a time feel like this isn't what you thought you signed up for?
Yeah, I think there were definitely times in my career where I looked around and said, this doesn't feel right to me. This doesn't feel like presenting an opportunity for players to better themselves and ultimately create an organization that is more likely to win baseball games. You know, my personal experience, I was not someone who was drafted in the lower round, so I actually got a good signing bonus. And, you know, I didn't have to struggle for the first few years. I was able to rent my own apartments. I was able to eat what I wanted. And I very quickly realized how much money that hemorrhages when your paychecks coming in to replace it are so little. And I started hemorrhaging through that money very quickly as a young, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old with very little financial literacy. You know, I started realizing that this is extremely difficult to do if you're not someone who was paid a few hundred thousand dollars out of the draft. And the vast majority of players who come into minor league baseball are not paid more than $100,000 for their signing bonus. And then obviously you have taxes on top of that. So a lot of guys, that initial signing bonus goes straight into a savings account because it's all you have for the next 7 years if you don't make the big leagues.
And that's got to be hard, I'm guessing, because you're working full time in this field. Is there even time to get a second job?
So during the season, no. During spring, no. And during the fall if you're in instructs? No. Most of the time, if you get a secondary job, it's a seasonal job that runs somewhere from September, October to right around February. A lot of guys do Lyft and Uber, or they work retail, or they work in warehouses. I've done all three of those things throughout my career. And the biggest issue is the jobs that are available or the hours that you have to work aren't necessarily conducive to your training schedule. And so it becomes very difficult to balance that, you know, training at an elite level, making sure that your body is in the right spot, making sure you're able to eat enough food to maintain your weight and your muscle mass and recover. And also going into work 8-10 hours a day, putting that strain on your body, and, you know, doing that just so you can keep your head above water so that you can afford the food that you need to eat to recover for the job that you're training for. It kind of becomes this vicious cycle of money in, money out, just to maintain the ability to play the game.
Have you heard from any major league players that are supportive of your cause, of bringing attention to this?
Yes, absolutely. I think probably one of the most prominent ones is Sean Doolittle. He has been a voice for positivity in the game for a long time. And he has continued to step up and support the movement. And there have been others, Jose Ramirez, Chris Taylor, they've worn the fair ball wristbands. Trey Mancini, I could go on and on. There are a lot of players who support this because there are a lot of players who have lived that reality in the minor leagues and have seen teammates, friends. I mean, these players and these teammates become like a family to you, and to watch them have to suffer through poor wages and not being able to see their family and having to eat, you know, less than quality food, and seeing that effect on their mental health. I think that has a pretty profound effect on most players, because it shouldn't be that way if we're trying to create a team or an organization that has the goal of winning in mind.
It's got to be complicated too. I'm thinking of the relationships where, you know, you have a teammate that goes on to the major league and they're getting paid much more and they're remembering where they came from. But at the same time, I'm guessing there's going to be guilt to be moving up and then everybody else is still getting paid really basic.
I personally wouldn't know. You know what I can say just from having a free agent deal. So after your 7 years of minor league contract, you're able to sign free agent minor league deals, which you can substantially increase your pay. Of course, it takes 7 years to do so. And there were times even when I was receiving substantially more than the other players on my team because I was on a free agent deal. And if I wasn't performing, I felt guilt during that time because I almost didn't feel like I was worthy of that pay, just because of what we've been so conditioned to. When one player is getting $1,500 a month and one player is getting almost $20,000 a month to be on the same team, that discrepancy can be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that that's not a good feeling. Harry, you also played in the minor league for a couple of years. What was your experience like?
Yeah, so listen, my experience, and this was a little while ago, but 2012 through 2014, was consistent with, you know, Kieran's and so many other guys over the past few decades. I mean, I saw all of the same types of things firsthand, whether it was players, you know, struggling with housing, with meals, with, you know, making ends meet. You know, I've told this story before, but I vividly remember, walking into a teammate's, apartment, and they had 5 air mattresses laid on the ground in a 1-bedroom apartment. A pretty jarring thing to see, to be honest with you. Just not really a human way to live. I mean, honestly, I felt like those conditions were dehumanizing. And at the time, we were only, you know, 45 minutes up the road from the major league team, which was, you know, worth, you know, $2 billion. And I remember thinking, this just is not right on a fundamental level. Like, there are a lot of reasons why this shouldn't be happening from a performance standpoint, just from an economic standpoint. But in that moment, I remember feeling, this is just not morally okay. How are there people involved with this major league team that are okay with this happening down the road? Like, it just can't be the case. So this is really troubling. And, you know, I think something that is important to note is that the minor leagues are made up of a significant number of Latin American players, from Dominican Republic, from Venezuela, all manner of countries, a lot of very, very talented baseball players from that region who are signed and come, you know, come to America to be a part of this system and are drastically underpaid. And there are a lot more Latin players, as many as there are in the major leagues, there are way more at the lower levels of the minor leagues. As you move up levels, it gets, you know, whiter and whiter and whiter. And that also was really problematic to me, to see so many Latin American players who didn't speak the language, who didn't have any advocates for them, didn't have any union representing them, living five guys to a one bedroom apartment. It just felt like very, very exploitative. And it really, really bothered me.
You know, it's interesting. I was going to ask you about that. If there was sort of, some kind of systemic problems within baseball that would lead to us saying that, you know, maybe there is, a lot of exploitation at the lower levels because of the makeup of the team. Have you seen that changing over the years, or has it gotten worse?
So, you know, I'll give you an example, and it's not, unfortunately, a good answer. But so in minor league baseball, there's something called extended spring training, which is a period of from, you know, basically April until the draft in late June, when players who are not assigned out to a minor league team to go play games in front of fans stay back at the spring training facility and just train in the, you know, as they would during, you know, the offseason and spring training, to just prepare for this season. Those players are, you know, the numbers are pretty drastic. There's a lot of Latin American players that are in that extended spring training setup. Historically, players at extended spring training don't receive any salary, even though they're working 6 days a week, going to the field, you know, all day, training, working out, playing, you know, all the whole nine. They don't receive any salary at all. And I can't help but think that part of the reason for that is that there are so many Latin American players who don't have a voice, who don't speak the language, who aren't going to speak up and complain about it. And to me, that has always been some of the most drastic exploitation in minor league baseball, because remember, you don't receive a salary all off season. So if you are one of these players who's assigned to extended spring training, you could go for an entire 12-month period, all of during which you are training, working for your employer, putting in hours to, you know, to try to become one of their major leaguers, and providing value to them in that way, you might only receive 3 months of pay. And that might amount to something like $3,000 for the entire year. And the fact that there are so many Latin American players in that situation, I think is something that is really, really problematic. And that Major League Baseball needs to take a hard look at.
Yeah, I mean, I'm honestly, I shouldn't say that I'm surprised, because nothing surprises me these days. But at the same time, I'm just speechless that this has been going on and nobody really knows about it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the reason that people don't know about it is for so long there has been a culture of fear of speaking up. As Kieran said, there's a carrot out there, which is, one day I'll be able to make the major leagues and make it, you know, and become rich. And, you know, what they don't tell you is that's only going to happen for, you know, something like 10%, if that, of minor league players. For the vast, vast overwhelming majority of minor leaguers, that big payday is never going to come. And they're going to have been exploited, as a result during their minor league years. And, you know, obviously something our organization exists to do is to embolden players to speak up, to draw attention to it. And, you know, I think it's worth mentioning that Kieran was one of the first players, if not the first player, to really put his name behind this and come out and say, this is how minor leaguers are treated. And it was so jarring that ESPN ran a story on it that was, you know, basically at the top of their page for a couple of days, because people were like, wow, they couldn't believe something that, you know, those of us inside the game have known for a long time. It's been a really, really well-kept secret, and it has taken players like Kieran and others who have been willing to buck that longstanding trend of staying silent in order to really start to raise awareness about it. And candidly, that's the only reason we're even on this show today having a conversation, is Kieran's bravery and the bravery of those like him who've said, it's time to stop suffering in silence. We have to draw attention to this, because anybody who hears what's really going on is not going to be happy about it, and is going to want to hold MLB to account, and is going to want to see some change. And, you know, a couple months later, we're starting to see that.
Well, Kieran, we have about a minute till we go to break. What was it that compelled you to speak up about this?
I think first and foremost, it is that deep kind of irrational love for the game. I got in about 10 years ago, and now coming out, realizing that the game hasn't really made any positive progress in that time, irked me a little bit. And seeing the next generation continually come in year after year, the new draftees, and seeing them come in kind of bright-eyed and with all this hope, and then to see that kind of get diminished year after year when they realize the realities of minor league baseball, over time that has really started to wear away at me and diminish my hope for the game. So now moving forward, I just want to make sure that that next generation is completely taken care of, that they don't have to deal with the same struggles that we've dealt with for 40 years.
Coming up after the break for the final segment, we'll learn about a former Indiana lobbyist and author of a new political thriller. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. It's the Friday recap where we look back at a few of our favorite conversations we had this week. A reminder, this show is not live. For our final segment today, we'll hear from a former Indiana lobbyist and author of a new political thriller. We're speaking with Michael Leppert today, lecturer at the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University and author of Flipping the Circle, a political thriller. The National Election Study has been measuring public trust in government since 1958. And although there was a small increase in the last couple of years, trust has gone down significantly overall. And I know this is a broad metric, but what do you think about how the public views government right now, especially related to the kinds of things you want people to know about?
I think there's just a lot of work to do, and I worry that people in government and around government, and I was both of those for the bulk of my career, need to take that kind of polling seriously. And I've seen those polls and shared that kind of information with my classes over time, and it's important. I mean, people need to have confidence the same confidence that I have when I communicate to people. People usually come to government for all the right reasons, and staying true to that is important. But it's a work that never ends. I mean, you can't be lazy, apathetic, or corrupt on Friday and come back in on Monday and start clean. Those kinds of things are commitments that need to be in place when you walk in the door, and you need to stay there. And so I think that not having confidence in government says a lot, but what are we all doing collectively to insist on more from our government? You know, these last few years where I imagine there's been some deterioration just because of the partisan nature and the division that's in the country. No one trusts each other. Both sides of that equation have equal responsibility to do something about that. And I sometimes don't get the sense that the long-term value of that is given them enough priority in exchange for a short-term benefit.
I want to talk about some of the lessons that you have taken away with your experience working in this realm, and then also this book, and what you want other people to learn from what you've gone through. Is there anything you hope sticks with people after they finish the book?
Well, I think one of the people who read the book before it came out talked a little bit about this with me and commented on the cover for me, Andrew Stoner, who I met when he was working in government 20 years ago, before he went off to be a professor in a variety of schools. But you know, he's a thinker, and what I want people to know is that we still do have control of this. I think a lot of people, based on the polling you just mentioned, we really do have control. We get into the habit of acting like it's too big and thinking that we don't matter individually, and those sorts of things. And I consider all those to be thinking errors. I really do. I think that people need to understand that their involvement, their engagement actually does matter. It matters even right now when they may not believe that it does. It still does. And so we have to get back into the habit of understanding that this is our own garden. You know, we have to go out and weed it, and we have to tend to it, and it grows and it dies, and it grows and it dies, and we have to do all of those things consistently. It's never going to change. It's never going to go away. And so all of us collectively have to, I think, have a healthier attitude about what our role is and what our responsibilities are there. And if that would improve a little bit, our confidence probably would rise with it.
You mentioned earlier sort of this market of influence that's been growing, and it seems like it's taken on a world of its own. Would you say that being involved in lobbying in some form is better than actually running for a position?
Boy, what a great question. you know, there are so many ways to be impactful. I don't think that the only way to be impactful is to go out and run and win an election. There are times when I felt like what I was doing was the best possible way for me to contribute to whatever it was in front of me. As a lobbyist, you know, as an advocate for something, you know, lobbyists are always viewed as just doing things for money, but there were a lot of really important things, you know, bias crimes legislation and other kinds of conservation stuff that I did over time where I was the guy running the campaign. And these were all things that were, you know, all about making human progress. Being involved is the real measure. Are you going to be involved and engaged in this thing or not? And so there are lots of ways to do that. There are lots of ways to be involved. You don't have to run for office to do it. It's a great thing if you do. But you can advocate and you can write letters and you can organize campaigns and you can hold people accountable without running for office. And all of those things collectively matter a lot more than I think the current culture believes them to do.
Is there anything that makes it more difficult for folks to get involved in local politics than it should be? I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is, has it become sort of this like insiders club and people sort of have this order of people like you're next and then we're going to work for you to get you out on the ballot and then next time it's your turn. How does that work out?
Well, I think the biggest barrier, the biggest barrier for people being more involved is the time that it takes. I spend a good chunk of most lectures about, in my public law class talking about time. And that's just not from the respective citizen involvement, but also from advocacy involvement and from legislative and process involvement. We see a lot of this in the news right now, deadlines being issued and then broken and reissued and all that sort of stuff has been, you know, a big exercise of late in Washington. But time, I think, is the thing that we in the private sector is so valuable. You know, if you get on a website right now, they're timing you. They want to know how long you're on their website, and they want to know how successful they can be in closing a sale with you based on how much time you're on that website. The same applies with government. You know, it should be easy and it should be convenient to vote, but it should also be convenient to participate in a public meeting or a public forum. It should be very convenient to communicate, and there shouldn't be a bunch of barriers. And neither side of that communication is served with that inefficiency built in. And so my thing is not really about limiting influence as much as it is about making it easier and more convenient and taking less time for people to be involved. You know, people are busy. You spend 12 hours a day working your job and taking care of your family, and you've got 15 minutes to give away to your government. That 15 minutes should be enough time, or that 5 minutes should be enough time for you to voice your concern in an efficient way so that the people who need to hear it can hear it. And that's probably the number one thing that I would focus on, dealing with time.
Absolutely. I think time is definitely a key thing for folks to keep in mind, because people who aren't in the day-to-day politics, you know, have other lives outside of it. The other thing I was thinking of, just as a journalist, when I used to cover government meetings or go to things, you do feel a little awkward sometimes going into a committee room or something. It's like, am I okay to be in here? You know, like, so some kind of more welcoming thing, but I guess people don't want to welcome journalists in case there's something they don't want us to know. But in general, I'm just thinking for folks to want to attend meetings and get involved, just making it feel like it's for everyone.
Yeah, see, and I was the other extreme. When I worked for government, I very early was given assigned the the task of dealing with the media. And so the media to me were like royalty. I mean, when they showed up, it was like, can I get you a cup of coffee? You know, well, what can I do to make your stay here more pleasant? That was the way I was trained. And the person who trained me on how to deal with the media was a former reporter. So that always stuck with me. But the same thing, there's a scene in the book where the lead character in the book has to sign his name to get into a public meeting. And he takes issue with it, a small issue, and it's a little quirky conversation. But that in and of itself is an unnecessary burden. Why should I have to sign in to come into this meeting? It's public. And, mm-hmm. and those kinds of little things, they erode people's desire and willingness to be involved. And all those little things collectively really are things that we ought to look at and be intolerant of. Because our time is just as important as those dignitaries who were sitting behind the bench making these big decisions. Those people work for us, and they should be welcoming to us and inviting us in and getting us a cup of coffee when we come in to be involved with it. That's always been my approach to public involvement, and I think everyone should adopt that. Our trust in government would go up immediately if we did that.
That's a good perspective to have, to say you work for me.
Yeah,
okay. So, and it's hard to see that, because I think sometimes you feel like maybe I work for them because I'm supposed to follow all the rules.
Oh yeah, well, you feel that way, and that's part of the story in the book. I remember when I first walked into the state house. It's this, and I've been in lots of state houses now. And you go in, and there's huge limestone walls, and all these big leather-backed chairs, and sir, and the honorable, and all those kinds of words are used with the people who are in there. And it's all very intimidating for people who were there for the first time. It took me a year to get used to all that stuff and to get back to the reality of the situation is that these are just people just like I am. They've got a job to do just like I do. And we should be able to call them, Bob and Betty and get on with the work at hand instead of, going through all these, charades that separate people.
What is it like being a progressive and trying to enact change in Indiana and the Republican majority state house?
It's exhausting. No, you have to pick your spots. That was the case even when government was more shared. It's frustrating, and it would be equally frustrating, I think, for a lot of Hoosiers if it were flipped around the other way. And in any state where it's too lopsided. Most lobbyists are going to tell you, people who are at this business for a long time, that equally divided government is really the way to go. That's the time when really bad ideas get filtered, get modified, or just get buried. And it's also a time, much like we're seeing in Congress right now, people are unhappy with the process on these big bills that President Biden is supporting. The majorities out there are so thin. They can't just be cavalier about doing these things, and they have to be cognizant of other interests, not just the most loud voice in the room. And so being a progressive in Indiana right now is not ideal, obviously. But I wouldn't want it to be flipped around the other way for very long either, because I think that we're all served if we can listen to everybody and come up with a solution that works for the most of us instead of just the loudest or the people occupying power at the time.
Mm-hmm. So a nice, happy balance in the middle.
Oh, yeah. And when I first worked in the state house, there was that balance. The Senate was Republican. The House was Democrat. Our governor in Indiana is a very weak position with regard to policy changes legislatively, with a simple majority veto authority for the legislature. And so having the chamber split, prevented a lot of bad ideas from becoming law. And the process is hard enough as it is, but that extra layer of check and balance on one another is extremely valuable. So most of the states are all one party or the other. And I think that is this period of time where that's true is going to prove to be a period of some really bad policy making.
I want to go back to your class that you mentioned earlier, that you teach a college class about a lot of these issues. What have you heard from students? Anything surprising coming from them? I feel like the students today are maybe Gen Z or somewhere along that line where they have a lot of social media. And so they get a lot of information coming at them. So I wonder how they're able to process all of this stuff.
Yeah. You know, the younger generation is an exciting one for me. I mean, obviously, I spend most of my time with, you know, the 18 to 22 year old crowd now. So I hope that their youthfulness is rubbing off on me a little bit. But they, you know, they care about a lot of things that I think people don't give them credit for. And there are some things that are just perfunctory in this generation that, you know, that are just, you know, embedded in them that are not embedded in my generation. I'm 54 years old, and there are a lot of people my age who haven't adjusted to seeing LGBT people in this, you know, as an equal, you know, that the racial strife, and the racial perspective is different in my generation than theirs. The environmental and the climate challenges are different. So you talk to somebody, any of my students that are, you know, 18, 20, 22 years old, and you talk to them about burning coal, and they're going to look at you like, I can't believe we still do that, you know, or, you know, discriminating, being able to fire somebody because they're a member of the LGBT community, or restricting who can be a victim of a hate crime because of a member in one minority group or another, or their lack of membership in one of those groups. And the younger generation just looks at you and they don't even understand what the problem is. And that gives me a lot of optimism that some of the things that I've struggled with my whole adult life don't make much sense. I see them seeing them with a more objective and a more healthy view than people who've grown up with other baggage. And so I have a lot of optimism for the future with the people that I've been around the last few months in school. That's for sure.
I was going to ask you if you were worried at all about the future of politics here in Indiana, but it sounds like you're optimistic.
Oh, I'm very, very optimistic. And this group is not, they're not all uniformly classic Democrats or leftists. I think a lot of them are have a libertarian streak in them, but they don't see a reason why when they look at a problem. This is the school shooting generation. They look at school shootings and they think, why do we keep letting this happen? You know, there has to be something that we should do. Inaction makes no sense to them because there's clearly a problem. And so those kinds of things, that's the kind of feedback I get from my students. We just finished reading the book that Shannon Watts wrote for Moms Demand. And the reason why we're writing it, it's not because of the gun issue. We're reading it because of movements. And the class, I didn't realize this until we got done with the book, how much they really enjoyed that book. They really loved that story, loved the book. So those kinds of things are and other feedback is just, it's very encouraging to me that the people who take over in the future are going to be just fine.
We have about a minute left. Any words of wisdom for folks who may want to dip their toe in the water and get involved? You know, what should they start with?
Well, I would tell them not to dip their toe in the water. I would tell them cannonball right in the middle of the pond. That's what I would tell them. This anybody who thinks that there's a barrier, they should be intolerant of what they think that barrier is, whatever it is. If it's a time thing, if it's a signing your name in to get to a public meeting, if it's a voter registration mistake or problem or challenge, you know, keep charging ahead. Don't let anybody deter you, and always approach government and politics as if it belongs to you, because it does. And that whole ownership, act like an owner. You know, the firm that I just left always told us to act like we own the place, because we do. That's exactly how people ought to treat their government here. Act like you own it, because you do.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Michael Leppert, lecturer at the Kelly School of Business at Indiana University and author of Flipping the Circle, a Political Thriller. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.